Chapter 2, The Morality of Culture. Races are organisms with limited lifespans. Cultures can be viewed as organisms, the existence and duration of which often seem synchronized with the lifespan of a particular race, tribe, or population group. When a culture changes, as it does when outsiders take possession of it, it dies in the sense that it loses most of its original content. It may leave behind some residues, just as a father leaves behind some of his genes to his children. But the child is never the same as the father, and the successor culture is never the same as the culture that preceded it. Organisms expire from many causes: old age, disease, accident, even from despair. The causes of cultural death are not too dissimilar. A culture grows repetitive, stodgy, and senile, as an aging human does. It may be corrupted and perverted when in full flower. Unforeseen historical happenstances can kill a culture as efficiently as a head-on collision with another automobile can wipe out a family on a Sunday drive. The wrong military alliance at the wrong time, a drastic change in the weather, the depletion of critical resources, any of these factors or all working together can mortally wound a culture. Tradition is the atmosphere in which culture breeds and breathes. Never to be discounted is the cumulative effect of cultural aggression carried on by outsiders who pose as insiders. In such cases, tradition is no longer a shield, but a punching bag. Man, a partner of nature, cooperates with nature to produce the phenomenon of culture. To say that culture is separate from man or independent of man is to say that atoms have no connection with their molecules. Human life adapts to a particular environment and in the process produces a particular type of man. There is no dividing or compartmentalizing the process. Once man settles in a specific environment, he may remain longer than the environment itself, which, when largely man-made, can change faster than man, in some cases faster than man can catch up with it. The hereditarian puts too much emphasis, not on the importance of inheritance, but on man in general, as if man was a thing apart. Gung-ho environmentalists commit a grave sin by giving man's biological component only a fraction of the importance and influence accorded to culture and nature. Yet man, as has already been pointed out, is a part of nature and at the same time the key component of culture. Nurturists will surely comprise some of the bitterest opponents of the ethnostate, which calls for biological restructuring to precede cultural restructuring. A state based on racial and cultural similarity can have little appeal to those who consider race a stumbling block and culture a self-generated construct that springs fully grown and ramified, like Athena, from the forehead of Zeus. The ethnostate offers no false dawns, no airy promises that groups from less complex cultures, when brought into contact with more complex ones, will acquire in a decade or two what it took another breed of human centuries to develop. It is both unhealthy and impractical for a culture to borrow from another what it could not create under its own power. The less articulated culture then assumes a burden it is incapable of carrying. Sooner or later, cultural accretions are likely to be rejected, just as the transplant recipient may reject a new heart or kidney. Is there some kind of biological pulse, some kind of pulmonary rhythm at work in races which causes them to have slower heartbeats and to breathe more slowly than their human components? As he ages, the individual becomes ever more aware of death, which, when it overtakes him, becomes a matter of public record. No one ever really knows exactly when a culture dies. Unawareness of death, even at the moment it strikes, makes it difficult to date a culture's lifespan. The question of art and non-art. What is the sense of telling someone a story if the listener cannot understand what he is being told? If art, a form of communication, fails to communicate, it fails in its main purpose. The only ones who understand the incomprehensible work of modern artists are their agents, a few rootless dilettantes, and some speculators. An unknown artist whose output suddenly becomes all the rage is a money tree, not to mention the tax deductions accumulated by his patrons when his art is donated to a museum at highly inflated values. As to more mundane levels of communication, such as speech, it is easier to speak to a small crowd than a large one, easier to speak to people like yourself than to foreigners. Men and women who speak the same language do not have their words interrupted by passing them through the filter of translation. Those who live in a state populated by their own kind are not bombarded by the confusing and often contradictory messages that are the lingua franca of multiracial states. The inhabitants of an ethnostate are much less apt to be assaulted or outraged by art foisted upon them by racial and cultural oddballs motivated to alienate rather than to please the artistic sensibilities of the host population. Art flourishes when it both reaches up and reaches down. It is a collective enterprise in which the artist's mission is to satisfy and fulfill his people's artistic needs. The biological link reinforces the artistic urge and raises it to a higher plane than could be attained by a writer, painter, or composer working in an alien environment in complete isolation from his people. Artificial fame and substantial financial rewards may indicate that someone is an artist, but in the long run, it is his art and his art alone which gives him authenticity. His own people, and no other people, not himself, not his publicist, no alien or androgynous critic, will be the final judge. When his own people do not understand him, no one will. Lack of understanding and incomprehension on the part of his natural audience transforms what the artist conceives to be art into non-art. If the Athenian population in the 5th century BC had not resonated to the plays of Sophocles, there would have been no Sophocles, or at least the Greeks and those who came after them would never have attended a Sophoclean play. Today, the level of public understanding is so low, the artistic sensibilities of the public so stunted, that about all that is left of drama is its lowest common denominator, the commercial-loaded television sitcom. Like a telephone conversation, art is a two-way communication. When the line is cut, there is no connection. The ethnostate will give art a lift by providing it with a homogeneous audience. The artist will now know with whom he is dealing. He will no longer have to dilute, vulgarize, simplify, or sensationalize his work to make it more intelligible and palatable to a culturally and racially diverse audience. The ethnostate will give him true artistic freedom, since he will escape the censorship that suffocates creativity in a multiracial state, where the artist is at the mercy of an army of differently attuned critics, ready and eager to pounce on him for lacking sensitivity towards one or another population group, and ready and eager to denounce him for the slightest manifestation of his own ethnic pride. These same critics, it might be added, are usually quite supportive of ethnic pride, provided it is restricted to their own population group. The art that counts is the art that gives people a spirited and spiritual boost. In a multiracial, pluralistic state, art is reduced to meaningless pap, ever larger doses of obscenity in plays and literature, whose purpose is to shock, not uplift, ever louder drum beats in music, and ever more tasteless daubs on canvas. Modern artists often appear to be more interested in posing and posturing as artists than in art itself. They seem locked into the habit of encumbering their painting, sculpture, music, and literature with excerpts from political statements and campaign speeches. Some of the richest, most successful, and most influential of these artists may actually lack a genetic capacity for art. Jewish artists are descended from a people whose orthodox sects have observed millennia-old religious strictures against graven images. Those other Semites, the Arabs, have compensated for their religiously ordained prohibition against painting the human figure by developing graceful and artistic lettering and some beautiful architecture. In addition to the era of high art in ancient Greece, there were moments in Renaissance Florence, Elizabethan England, and Goethe's Weimar when the artistic tastes of the cultivated classes and the people were almost in tune, when theater audiences were on an equal footing of cultural sophistication with the playwright. Such rare explosions of genius may provide a foretaste of the high art that should emerge from ethnostates. In multiracial states, art, especially popular art, inevitably becomes regionalized. The most important American painters in the 20th century are the Midwest regionalists, Grant Wood, Thomas Benton, and Edward Hopper. The most listened to music was and is the country music of the South, the hit tunes of Broadway and Hollywood, and the Negro jazz that originated in the saloons of New Orleans, Memphis, and Chicago. The most significant literature was produced in the South, William Faulkner and Thomas Wolfe, and the Midwest, Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Art in America no longer springs from the country at large and from the people at large. For want of a better definition, art is subtlety. It is not a proper medium for propaganda. Today, Westerners are often forced to adopt a form of reverse racism as a defense against artists who skillfully mount racist attacks against them. Everyone is so obsessed with racism these days, there's little time for anything else, least of all, art, unless the art directly serves a racial agenda. Times of change are marked by the dying and birthing of races and cultures. Dying is often one long process of spiritual and bodily degeneration, which translates into degenerate art. Birthing is a synonym for immaturity, inexperience, and lack of control. But whereas the youngster grows into an adult, the oldster looks only toward the grave. Out of the warm self-centeredness of young civilizations can evolve the cool assurance, sophistication, depth, and control that are the building blocks of high culture. If one or more of the West's minorities should prove to be the inheritors of the future, no genuine art will emerge until they free themselves from the cultural legacies of the majorities they have overcome. Miscegenation with the remnants of the once dominant majorities will simply speed up the minorities' own degeneration. History proves again and again that high art is the product of homogeneity. When heterogeneous elements flow in to partake of the material comforts of the high civilization that go hand in hand with high culture, the art curve slopes downward. Art critic Joseph Wood Crutch has written, quote, "The only dangerous threat to an established morality is a new morality," unquote. He is both right and wrong. An alien morality imposed on a declining native morality may produce a hybrid morality that degenerates into immorality. Without morality, art quickly descends into pornography. One of popular art's most nagging questions is, how far can it be divorced from reality? In late 20th century art, role reversal has almost become an inviolable rule. Negroes commit crimes hugely disproportionate to their numbers, but in order not to exacerbate racial feelings and in an effort to blur the gruesome statistics of black crime, films and plays constantly feature black good guys and white bad guys. In TV sitcoms, producers and writers go out of their way to have the Negro grade school student, who in real life has a lamentable scholastic record, answer a teacher's question correctly almost before the white student can raise his hand. The psychological effect of this deception on white students is difficult to assess. One thing is certain, at an early age, white children are subject to a barrage of songs, cartoons, and TV shows about race, which they soon learn from first-hand experience to be false. To know that popular art is a medium for deception creates suspicion about all art, even great art. Forced acculturation. Though military aggression is the most serious form of foreign interference into matters of state, cultural aggression comes in a close second. Adverse reactions are to be expected whenever and wherever any population group is persuaded or forced to adopt the customs and manners of another population group by economic and political pressure or by some other intrusive means, such as being co-opted into the population of the aggressor by marriage or less lawful forms of interbreeding. Despite all the approval lavished these days on the notion of cultural diffusion, what really happens to an indigenous culture under attack is similar to what an individual exposed to a disease-carrying virus undergoes. Aside from preventing people from living according to their predilections, cultural aggression brings in its wake other more subtle and less apparent evils. Who would deny that jazz has not made unhealthy inroads in cultures whose music, particularly folk music, differs so radically from that of the Negro? In earlier times, when the tables were turned, were not the musical talents of slaves distorted when they heard the unsyncopated rhythms and melodies of their southern masters? For centuries, Western culture has had an almost irresistible attraction for Asians and black Africans. Tens, if not hundreds of millions of non-whites have adopted Western ways to the disdain and despair of other hundreds of millions of their kin who have remained loyal to their native customs. Cultural aggression, which may precede or follow military aggression, fills the great reservoir of human disagreement to overflowing. It would be greatly curbed, if not eliminated, in a world of ethnostates, since each separate population group would be encouraged, indeed practically compelled, to keep its culture at home. Every ethnostate's culture would be self-embargoed and labeled not for export. The cultures of some population groups, depending on the time and place, are often too delicate to endure too many severe shocks, either external or internal. Conversely, some cultures are often tough enough to outlast military occupation and long periods of persecution by what would seem to be more dynamic cultures. Perhaps the second worst crime in mankind's book, after genocide, is culturecide. In the present-day West, crime, joblessness, and economic jolts are less dangerous and threatening than the counterculture of drugs, homosexuality, heavy metal cacophony, decadent liberalism, pornography, and minority paranoia, a counterculture that is not seeking to modify or change the culture it is attacking, but to erase it. Countercultures are quasi-cultures. At bottom, they are anarchistic and destructive reactions to the discipline, responsibility, and concentrated effort needed to keep any culture viable. Although it is often a severe mental and physical strain for people of rudimentary cultures to live up to the standards of high cultures, it is just as much of a task for the possessors of highly articulated cultures to defend their precious possessions against the incessant assaults of countercultures. Members of the same race have little difficulty adapting to the different cultures of other members, since race is an important determinant of culture, and the cultures developed by members of the same race are not all that disparate. Non-English-speaking Northern Europeans easily and quickly adapted to the Anglo-Saxon core culture of Australia, New Zealand, British Canada, and the United States. To evolve, culture needs constant challenges, but they should come from within, not from without. A culture torn and frazzled by interracial conflicts is hobbled by the amount of energy it must waste asserting and proving its own worth and uniqueness. Only a culture that is sure of itself, that has the freedom and resources to work towards perfecting itself, without excessive internal and external interference, can attain the heights to which it aspires. When asking about a particular culture, a better question than where it comes from is where it is going. One of the great problems of culture is how to preserve it without petrifying it. Aesthetics. If there are absolute standards of beauty, then some races or population groups, because they have a greater concentration of the physical traits that conform to these standards, would have to be judged more attractive than others. In a multiracial state, this preponderance of attractiveness in the genetic makeup of one or more groups is a constant thorn in the side of those who possess fewer of these premium traits. Over time, aesthetically ruffled feelings do little for political and social harmony. By keeping different racial and ethnic groups geographically apart, the envy and animosity engendered in the population groups considered less attractive will be sharply reduced, if not altogether eliminated. Living entirely with their own kind, the citizens of ethnostates will not be reminded on a daily basis of their also-ran status in world beauty pageants. Nor will TV commercials, newspaper ads, and billboard posters overawe them with the faces and physiques of members of more handsome population groups. If beauty standards are not absolute, if they are determined by the dominant population group in any society, as Marxists and equalitarians tell us, racial separation provides a better solution to the problem than waiting for a jealous subject race to rise up, overpower the ruling establishment, and set its own standards of beauty. The quick way out of such an aesthetic impasse is to have population groups define their own ideals of beauty without the interference and presence of other groups. Physical attractiveness would be measured by internal comparisons, not by invidious comparisons with other races. There is some truth to the equation that art plus genetics equals aesthetics. Art is a transcendent experience fixed in paint, stone, words, and musical notes. When Christ was painted, sculpted, or otherwise described as a Middle Easterner, Christianity had difficulty catching fire in Northern European hearts. To conform to the Nordic view of Christianity, even Lucifer was often depicted with a fair complexion. How else could he have so successfully tempted people with light hair, light skin, and light eyes? Ugliness in the eye of the beholder does not tempt. In a world of ethnostates, let the racial stereotypes flourish, but let them be restricted to the homogeneous population groups of each ethnostate and not flow across borders, where they proceed to stir up the racial mischief that has been so damaging to multiracial states. Cultural diversity contains an aesthetic component that may have a profound effect on the collective subconscious. Consider the United States. A century and a half ago, it was divided into fairly well-defined regions. The Deep South, the dry, semi-desert, cattle-breeding Southwest, Puritan New England, the farm country of the Midwest. Today, Dubuque is scarcely different from Orlando, Portland, Oregon from Portland, Maine. The same billboards, shopping malls, TV programs, gasoline stations, and fast food restaurants are omnipresent in modern America's 3,618,770 square miles of dreary sameness. By a twin process of concentration and isolation, ethnostates would first resist, then reserve this lemming-like rush to overall conformity. The all-but-extinct regionalism of America would be reborn and refurbished, as would the provinces of Europe, though many of the latter still retain remnants of their original character. Of the notable cultural benefits the ethnostate would bestow on mankind, perhaps the greatest would accrue to the eye, which would light up when by merely crossing the nearest frontier the traveler comes face to face with a different way of life, a distinct set of customs, a different art and architecture. Tourism, which has now deteriorated into driving or flying from sameness to sameness, would revert to its higher purpose, inspiring the serious traveler to learn more about himself by comparing his ways to the ways of strangers. At the same time, tourism for the sake of tourism, purely for the sake of traveling, should be limited. Too many such tourists tend to destroy the uniqueness of the places they visit. Too many cultural intruders distort native cultures. For this reason, ethnostatus, while developing a modern and efficient domestic transportation network, should not go overboard in promoting foreign travel and should do what they can to protect other ethnostates, as well as their own, from mass incursions of sightseeing Philistines. In the words of Robert Frost, who borrowed with acknowledgement an aphorism that appeared in an 1850 South Carolina almanac, "Good fences make good neighbors."